Hi, everyone. Welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint.
And I'm Julian Taylor.
And welcome to our podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to two follically challenged people and somebody who's not quite so follically challenged talking about safety. So Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. My name's Julian Taylor. I'm delighted to be joined by my shiny-headed friend from Nashville. How are you?
I'm lovely. How are you?
I am good. You might have noticed that we have been joined by a third person today. Really, really excited to be joined today by Paul Delderfield. And rather than me introduce you, Paul, it'd be really great if you could introduce yourself and I suppose give us a bit of background on who you are, how you got into safety, where you've come from and what you're currently doing.
Sure. Thanks, Julian. So, yeah, as you said, I'm Paul Delderfield. I'm from the Health and Safety Executive, which is the regulator of health and safety law in Great Britain. I'm a specialist inspector of health and safety, and I'm a specialist in noise and vibration. I've been with the HSE for just over 10 years now. Prior to that, I spent 25 years working in the automotive industry in the UK in consultancy, and before that in manufacturing, in noise and vibration, but not in health and safety specifically. So I had a lot of experience in noise and vibration, in control solutions, in essentially making cars quieter and sound nicer. Latterly, a lot of work on sound quality as well. And I was ready for a change, both in my personal life and professionally, and almost by random ended up joining the HSE because they were looking for noise and vibration specialists, people with extensive experience in industry and particularly knowledge of noise control. But as I say, I didn't have any background in health and safety at that point, but a lot of the principles are the same. And I've absolutely loved doing this job. It makes such a change for what I do to be having a direct impact on people's lives and on their long-term health. I wouldn't change it for anything.
Jules, right quick, I have to say I love how we're gonna get into noise and look what's behind him.
Yeah,
and the irony.
Yeah, and there is a certain irony that Paul does have a guitar hanging off his wall. He has secretly admitted to us that he can't play it yet. It's an ambition. But then we were all talking about going to rock concerts, and Langdon and myself have both been to concerts in the last sort of 7 days that probably far exceeded any sort of legal. Legal levels of noise within the workplace, didn't they, Paul?
Probably, yes. And it's an interesting point, actually, because we are the regulator of health and safety at work. So for the audience at events like that, it isn't a work activity. But equally, there are the people who are working there all day to be considered. You know, the people doing the sound recording, the band themselves, the people. Operating the various retail outlets and things who are potentially are doing work activities and are being exposed to high noise levels.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's also, I think it's worth, that brings up a good point before we kind of transition more so. I think noise is something, and hearing protection and all those elements are something we take for granted. Across the board, even when you think about it in the workplace, there are stringencies in place which should be there. Same as here in the States, and you think, oh, I'm over, I'm 93, I need my hearing protection, but yet we'll go to fireworks shows, concerts for hours, which are excessively over that, and you don't think anything about it. I think one that is, to me, in the workplace, at home, it really doesn't matter. The noise adverse effects are something we take for granted, in my opinion here.
Well, I would go even further. I think if you look at sort of the change in technology over the last 20 years with smartphones and with the sort of the buds that go alongside them, how many people are, I always think it when I'm on public transport and somebody's got their headphones on next to me and you can hear just about what they're listening to, I think straight away that's a signal that it's too loud. And I often want to tap people on the shoulder and say, excuse me, can I talk to you? But kind of the polite Englishness of me prevents me from doing it very often. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good observation. I think any noise above a certain level can be harmful, and it is a strange combination that we consider it to be a risk at work, but perhaps we willingly expose ourselves in other environments. But there is, I suppose one way to look at it is that, you know, noise induced hearing loss does tend to be a cumulative thing. For most people, it's a cumulative effect of lots of years of quite high noise exposures. Obviously, there are unusual circumstances where you could be exposed to a very high noise and get some instantaneous loss. But most of the time, for most people, it's a cumulative, gradual loss over a lot of years. And so, you know, that shouldn't mean that we therefore don't protect against it at work. In fact, you could use that as an argument to say that we should make more effort to protect against it in the workplace to allow for the, you know, for the inevitable exposures outside of work, which are potentially more difficult to control.
I was going to catch up on this later, but I think it's maybe a good time to talk about it now, Paul, and I know when we sort of got together and thought about recording this, we talked very much about what are the, if somebody has a hearing issue caused by sort of the workplace, I suppose, what are the repercussions of that in personal life, in social life, and so on?
I talk quite a lot on this subject, and one of the things I always try to emphasize is that noise-induced hearing loss is a particularly harmful form of hearing loss. It's different to the normal age-related hearing loss that we all tend to suffer from to varying degrees. Age-related hearing loss tends to affect high frequency more than anything else, and it's a gradual sort of rolling off of our high frequency response. But noise-induced hearing loss is effectively a notch in the spectrum of noise that you can hear clearly, and it's a notch at the frequencies which are really important to speech. So it's a notch around 6 kilohertz, which is where, or sort of four to 8 kilohertz, I suppose, which is where all of the sort of consonant sounds come, all the t and s and k, those sorts of sounds are formed in that sort of frequency range. And if you lose that, then you really do lose the ability to understand speech. I suppose it's a natural corollary of our ears being tuned to speech frequencies. You know, our ears are particularly sensitive to those frequencies, and that tends to be where you get hearing loss because of a resonance within the ear canal at those frequencies, because our ears are optimized for that. So consequently, it's not that you can't hear all sounds, it's just that you can still hear all the vowel sounds, you can still hear all of the ow-y type sounds, but you lose all the things that distinguish words. So you can't, you can still hear the sound, but you can't distinguish the speech anymore, which, as you can imagine, is particularly harmful to people's social lives, to their ability to mix with other people. And it gets particularly difficult when you're in a social environment where there's a lot of background noise going on, whether it's a large group of people or whether it's an environment like a restaurant or somewhere which tends to have a lot of reflective surfaces and you get a lot of background noise building up. And in those environments, you really struggle to pick out individual speech from people. So, you know, I know people with noise-induced hearing loss and with hearing loss generally, and the big thing they'll say is that, they just cannot, they cannot hold a conversation with somebody in a social environment, so they tend to just not bother and they miss out on that part of life.
So it's a really isolating, debilitating sort of health defect, isn't it, if it happens? So, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask the impossible question, Paul, which is, and I'm saying it's the impossible question because I know from some of the conversations we've had, it's you're doing a lot of work to try and sort of identify how much of an issue it really is across the UK. So I'm really interested for you to sort of talk to that in terms of, I know certain things are RIDO reportable, certain things aren't when it comes to your sort of field of expertise. You gave me one quite frightening statistic in terms of HAVs and carpal tunnel representing 50% of all ill health RIDOs that are reported. But how big a problem is it? And I suppose taking that noise bit out, how big a problem is the noise element?
Yeah, so as you've referred to RIDO there, which is the requirement to record incidences of ill health as well as accidents and things, and certain diseases, certain industrial diseases are classified as being reportable and certain aren't, and that decision goes back a long time, and actually it is currently under review at the moment. So out of all the ill health RIDOs we had in reported to the HSE in 2024, 58% were hand-arm vibration syndrome and carpal tunnel syndrome. The reason we lump carpal tunnel syndrome in there is because carpal tunnel syndrome only becomes reportable when it's associated with the use of vibrating tools. So if the person who gets a diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome isn't using vibrating tools, then it isn't reportable. It is reportable if they are, but that doesn't mean to say that it's been caused by the use of vibrating tools, just that they could have been an aggravating factor. So therefore it becomes reportable. So that's where the 58% comes from, a combination of those two things. But yes, at this moment in time, and since the RIDO regulations were last updated, noise induced hearing loss isn't a reportable disease. So consequently, we think it's still a big problem. Of all the workplaces I've visited in the last 10 years, a lot of them have had high noise levels, which would be a health risk. We've looked at other data sets like employer liability insurance claims, where noise-induced hearing loss is over 50% of all claims there as well. So, yeah, we think high noise is a high risk. There's been some research done in the States, I believe, identifying that noise-induced hearing loss is still a high risk, but we are a little bit lacking in data. So we are at the moment. The HSE is doing a focused inspection campaign of various industries, and one of the topics we're concentrating on is noise. So part of that means that we're gathering a lot of data about what sort of workplaces are noisy, how noisy are they, what are they doing about it. So at the end of this, our work year runs April to 1st of April to the end of March. At the end of this next work year, we hope to be drawing that research to a close, and we'll have enough data then to know whether it is as big a problem as we thought it was. But yeah, all the initial indications are that yes, it is a big problem still.
How are you seeing organizations in the UK being or managing it thus far? And what I mean by that is, in the States, for example, if you have a loud business, loud manufacturing process, yes, it is stringent. Everyone has to be, go through quote unquote testing, go through, make sure that levels are within the proper parameters. You do your personal decimeters, you might do your area surveys to determine it. And then if it is, honestly, for the most part, it seems like you just go straight to your PPE, because it's kind of that thought of, well, if this is the process, there's certain amounts of engineering that we can do to minimize that noise. So, you go through more of the admin aspect of potentially rotating workers or trying to put some barriers in between, things like that. But then it pretty much goes straight to PPE. What are you seeing? What are your thoughts around that from a regulatory aspect, with how companies are adopting it? What are they looking at? What are they thinking? And maybe what can we do differently for those?
Yeah, I think we see very similar here in Great Britain, most of the noisy workplaces I've been into, the only measure they've really considered is providing PPE, is providing hearing protection. The problem with that, and what I nearly always see, is that the hearing protection isn't being used properly. It's either not being worn properly in the first place. There's a lack of training for people as to how to fit earplugs, for instance, properly. A lack of training as to how to use ear muffs so that they're not being compromised by other PPE and things. So the consequence of that is that the employer thinks that the workers are being protected because they provided PPE, but the reality is that they often haven't got the level of protection that they think they have. And a lot of this seems to be coming, one of the other things we're looking at is where employers are getting advice from. And I've seen a lot of external noise reports or external advice given to companies which majors on measuring the noise, as you say, and then recommending that PPE be used. And if you read the Control of Noise Regulations or Control of Noise at Work Regulations, the actual logic it lays out is that you should assess the problem and then do something about reducing the noise. And then once you've done everything you can to reduce the noise, or while you're putting those measures in place, then you can use PPE, hearing protection, as an interim protection or as a last resort to protect if you can't do anything else. But yeah, I think my experience very much aligns with yours, that we're seeing a lot of PPE as the first port of call, not the last. Which would be great if you could rely on it and if it was providing the protection people thought it was. But like I say, so often it isn't.
It's that classic hierarchy of control, isn't it? Which I think is almost something that I don't want to say it's been forgotten in this country, but it's lost its level of importance, I think, that it should have. It used to be a sort of a focal point for a lot of people. And like you say, it's almost like the root of least resistance sometimes.
I think that's where the misunderstanding comes in, that people think that's going to be the easiest, cheapest solution. And there's so many cases where you can do something about the noise. And it'd be overall a lower cost. You know, you have to look at the overall cost, because it might cost more to change machinery or to do something about it. But if you can bring the noise exposures down below the upper exposure action value, which is 85 averaged over a day, then you don't need to be using hearing protection to the same extent. You don't need to be having potentially annual health surveillance. All of those things are additional costs. And when you think about, again, a lot of companies we see are just using disposable earplugs or just supplying disposable earplugs. And those should be one-use items. They should go in once and then be disposed of. And if you think of the cost of that, as well as the environmental impact of disposing of multiple foam earplugs a day, it really isn't as cheap as people perceive it to be.
Can you give, I know we talked about a couple of examples, Paul. I'm really interested. We're always sort of really interested in real world examples here. So sort of real world examples of where you've seen that done, where people have reduced the level of noise or used different technology.
So one of the things we've looked at recently, we've done some research work on this, which is just been published actually, is in woodworking machines. One good example of this is that you can reduce noise significantly without reducing quality by looking at the type of blades you're using in machines. For a start, by using sharp blades. Are usually a lot quieter, but there's some really good companies around supplying low noise blades these days, which again don't work out any more expensive, but like circular saw blades can be significantly quieter. But there's, in a lot of work, in woodworking machines, where they use normally a straight cutting blade, you can replace that with a helical cutting blade. So rather than all cutting, rather than cutting the blade cutting all in one go, it cuts gradually. And we've seen reductions in noise from going to those of over 20 dB, which is massive. Without reducing the quality of the surface finish, in fact, if anything, improving the surface quality, and also not being overall an additional cost, because there's various advantages to going to that. Another example, which I think we talked about the other day, is using air nozzles for blowing dust off parts. Again, an example of that was in a car body shop where they were using a lot of air nozzles to blow away dust after sanding and processes like that. And again, yeah, there are low noise nozzles available in the marketplace. They have been available for a long, long time. And they do just as effective a job as blowing away materials. But because of the design of the nozzle, it's designed that it doesn't have the same level of turbulence. So again, they can be 10 dB or more quieter than a normal nozzle. And often in an environment like that, that can easily be the most dominant noise there. And so I think I went to one place, and by changing one process from one type of tool to another one, which was quieter, plus changing the nozzles to low noise nozzles and reducing the air pressure slightly, they got a sufficient reduction in the daily noise exposure of workers that they didn't need to use hearing protection anymore. Just so I don't upset my industrial hygiene colleagues, the ideal solution would not be to blow dust away at all, but to use a vacuum to get rid of the dust. I don't want them beating me up for telling people to be blowing dust around.
So we've solved one problem and caused another one.
Let's not do that. Yes.
So some kind of extraction system might be
would be even better. Another example of where you can get multiple gains is for some applications in like horticulture work. You can quite easily these days change to battery operated tools instead of tools with petrol engines. And I did a visit a long time ago now to a local council where I live, and near I live, and they've changed over entirely to battery operated tools. So chainsaws, pole saws, hedge trimmers, all those sorts of tools, they've successfully moved over to battery operated tools. And in their instance, they're plenty powerful enough. The batteries last enough. They can take multiple batteries with them, and the tools they were using were significantly—they were quieter than a tool with an engine in some instances. In some instances, there was significantly lower hand-arm vibration to the person using the tool, but also they're getting rid of the fumes from the exhaust, and they're getting rid of the hazards of trying to refill hot tools with from petrol cans and things during the day. So, there's examples like that where you can get benefits across multiple areas.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this morning, Paul, because I was, I don't know whether you're a golfer or not, but I was practicing in a bunker this morning, and the greenkeeper came up and he wanted to trim round the edge of the bunker, just the grass around the edge of the bunker. And again, petrol powered trimmer. And the noise is incredible. It did make me laugh because I said to one of the guys who was there, I said, it does look a bit like my haircut when I go to the barber, and it's literally just taking the tufts off this.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but again, it's all really interesting examples, isn't it, that you don't think about, where actually, let's look at that hierarchy of control, and let's actually look at those opportunities to either eliminate or to use engineering controls to improve the situation. And you can do it, and like you say, there are multiple benefits and probably cost savings in the long run for business.
I mean at the end of the day, noise and vibration are effectively just wasted energy, aren't they?
So
not huge amounts in the scope of things, but they do indicate that there's stuff going on that isn't isn't as efficient as it could be. So
thanks for joining us today. It's been a great conversation with Paul about noise. We're going to carry that on again in a couple of weeks' time in part two.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. Don't forget to follow and subscribe wherever you stream your podcast, or you can visit us at evotix.com.
And if you've liked today's podcast or you've found some value from it, we'd really appreciate it if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review or a rating. It really means a lot to us. Thank you.